Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Now, we all know that South Africa is an open economy, one that participates on the global landscape. And as such, we have positive trade relations with key partners in the West and the East. Think BRICS, the likes of China and other emerging market partners. Think about the EU and specifically the UK. But tonight we're going to focus on the United States of America, a critical economy which we all know has been facing a lot of changes and shifts as they head up to the 5th of November, where the elections will take place there. Now, this does play an influence, as we all have gone to understand that politics and economics are very closely linked. And the outcomes in terms of the political voting that will take place later this year in the US will influence policies that will be implemented by the government in place. Now, this does speak to AGOA, the US African Growth Opportunity Act, which is essentially a critical tool that has facilitated duty-free trade between the United States of America and Africa. What does this look like going forward, and what influence will the elections play? Someone who can give us some perspective on this is political economist Professor Patrick Bond. Such a pleasure to have you with us this evening, Prof. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, and greetings to you and the listeners.
This is a conversation I think many of us do need to pay attention to, because it's been shifting. But maybe let's go back to AGOA as an act, and of course the opportunities and most importantly the role and function of trade between the US and South Africa. Just how significant is that single country as a key trade partner to South Africa and the continent?
Well, I must say, I hold a U.S. passport, so let me reveal my bias. I would love us to have much less trade, because I think it's generally damaging. It's a sort of trade that creates both dependency, especially upon a fickle U.S., a government from 2017 to 2020, that was Donald Trump, that may well reappear in an even more vicious way starting in January next year if he's elected in November. And what, even without the Trump factor, where there were restrictions put in on steel and aluminium exports in a completely whimsical, unjustified way, what we would expect would be that if Kamala Harris and her running mate to be determined, if they win, there'll still be very serious dependency and, let's say, fickle trade relations. And those will relate probably more to the climate because of our high carbon intensity, which means if we look at what we get from the AGOA relationship now, it's basically one company overarchingly benefiting. That's Mercedes, the automobile manufacturer from the East London Special Economic Zone. They only pay 15% tax. Mm. They use a large amount of electricity, as do the other car makers. The worst electricity, let's say guzzlers, would be BHP Billiton, the aluminium manufacturer in Richards Bay, and ArcelorMittal, the steel company. All of these companies I mentioned are international. They're not recycling their profits into South Africa, and they don't really reinvest. In fact, they're disinvesting by and large, with the exception of some of the car companies. And then the other major beneficiaries, aside from aluminium, steel, some other smelted metals, the automobiles, as well as some horticulture, the other is petrochemicals, where Sasol especially, which is partly South African but listed in New York. So if what we do in political economy, we ask a simple question: who wins and who loses? About 60 billion rand a year in trade that goes through AGOA, and it does bring down the price because they lower the tariffs. So more U.S. Buyers of those goods from South Africa get a cheaper price. The profits don't necessarily stay here. The electricity that's used is vast in relation to the output and to especially the jobs. About 42% of the electricity in the country is used by 27 multinational corporates. They even have a name, the Energy Intensive Users Group. They create just 4% of jobs. And when you look at the resources that they take, you know, the iron ore and the coal, the platinum, the gold, the manganese, these non-renewable resources, I think they create dependency because they take more out of the economy and the land and the society and the next generations than they put back. So I'm not really a fan of the kinds of trade relations that AGOA presents. And if we lose it, and especially for a good reason, that we call out the United States for its support for genocide, well, you know, so be it. It may actually help the economy if we can redistribute electricity to labor-intensive industries, small businesses, and households.
That sounds like there need to be a deliberate effort from a South African point of view, though, to re-industrialize the economy in order to make sure that there are sectors that are prioritized. I'd like to get your thoughts on that. But coupled with that, as you've described, perhaps the current structure of the AGOA Act isn't working favorably. What other considerations should perhaps be kept in mind in the negotiations in Washington to make sure that it's more favorable, specifically to a country like South Africa?
Well, yes, and not just South Africa. I mean, the renewal of AGOA, which is due to expire next year, obviously is being sped up by the Democrats, who control half of the Congress, the Senate, just barely. But they can speed this process up as a treaty-based process in the Senate. They have with now the Vice President, Kamala Harris, a 51-50 majority. And one of their big senators, the head of their Foreign Relations Committee for quite a long time, Robert Menendez from New Jersey, is about to be, well, just quitting because of corruption charges that seem very persuasive. The Egyptian government had bribed him. But the point being that there is, if you saw Benjamin Netanyahu speak to the U.S. Congress last night, there's a maniacal desire by U.S. imperialists to retain their relationship, especially to Israel, which is very important in financing these politicians through the, it's called APAC, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, and they can really trash anybody that's anti-Zionist or anti-genocide by basically flooding their opponents with money. They do that all the time. So I really felt in that, let me call it an axis of genocide that goes from Tel Aviv now very clearly to Washington. Of course, it involves London, not only the old conservatives, but the new Labour Party. It involves Berlin, the German Social Democratic Party, French government, although the new left plurality leaders in the parliament there may change things. And of course, Brussels, the head of the EU. That axis of genocide is something I think South Africa should be continuing to fight against. And the tragedy is that while we've put very strong messages of, you know, genocide by Israel out there, and the U.S. doesn't like that, obviously. They didn't like allegations that their ambassador, Ruben Brichetti, made that there were arms transferred to a Russian ship in Simonstown. Do you remember that in December 2022? Kind of wacky allegation, a wacky ambassador. He said, I bet my life on it. He couldn't prove it. Luckily, he didn't commit suicide, you know. But okay, so he never really came back. But he's still in Pretoria, you know, and what he did last week was offer $1 billion in loans, commercial loans, that the U.S. subsidy for green energy is only going to the U.S. banks that make those loans at very, very high interest rates once you incorporate the decline of the South African currency. So I'm, to be frank, as an American citizen, I'm disgusted by what the U.S. does. And when you mentioned at the beginning that BRICS is the alternative, let me just say how utterly disgusted I am by the BRICS as well. I think we've got to find some alternative, which, as you said, is industrialization from below, meeting people's needs, labor-intensive industries, clawing back things like clothing, textiles, footwear, appliances, electronics, the things that made South Africa 24% of our economy based upon manufacturing. That's now cut in half. And the 12% that's left is basically these very capital-intensive manufacturing like steel and aluminium and petrochems. And those are, as I say, a real waste of electricity when you think that could be used much, much more efficiently. And that means, I think, breaking some of these economic ties with BRICS partners, and it happens bit by bit. There are little bits of, you know, kind of protectionism against steel that just put in. But I think we have to be more aggressive and say, international economic relations aren't working for South Africa at the moment. Mineral depletion, which is a huge net drain, the pollution, the greenhouse gas emissions that come with it, and rebuilding our industrial base with labor-intensive strategies.
Prof, if we were at a dinner table right now in a room full of economists, we probably would have split the views of the various participants in the room. And I appreciate what you mentioned, and it almost seems as though a twofold attempt does need to be maintained. South Africa is currently experiencing incredibly weak weak growth. We are still struggling with major aspects such as sustainable energy, despite the small improvements we've made in the very, very short term. And I'm keen to get your thoughts here.
Not even so much improvements. You might have seen a speech that was given by Kuban Naidoo. Do you remember him? He was the
deputy
Reserve Bank governor.
Yes.
Yeah, and about 2 weeks ago, he gave a speech and he said, actually, half of our load shedding relief that we've had for about 115 days doesn't come from new supply, which we assume, because Kusile, the big, sort of corrupt plant that the Hitachi had bribed the ANC to get a chunk of and get that contract back in 2007. It did come online, having had a big crash a couple of years ago. But also, the crash in the minerals prices means that the demand from mining and especially smelting is much less than it had been. So we're in surplus, not just because of higher supply, but lower demand. So I appreciate that. I think that was an honest statement. And so we're making, let's say, minimal progress in, let's say, the grid might extend a little bit better if we can invest in transmission. We might have more, solar panels on our roofs, but still, it's a long way to go before we can say we're really decarbonizing at the rate we desperately need to avoid planetary arson.
Prof, I can imagine that, as we know, we have a team and a delegation under the DTIC, Department of Trade, Industry and Competition, out in Washington at the moment, looking to make sure that South Africa is a priority under the AGOA Act and that it will be, renegotiated and renewed under favorable conditions. But this ministry also has the responsibility of making sure that we do industrialize our local economy. If you had the ear of the minister, Park Stau, on the back of the feedback that you've just given us, what clear reforms and perhaps outcomes do we need to focus on to ensure that South Africa can resuscitate its economic performance, but most importantly, in a sustainable manner?
Well, thanks for the flattering fantasy, but to be realistic, I'll never have the ear, because as you say, if you put a room of economists together, I would be a dissenter. I'm a recovering economist, where I actually studied economics, included the Wharton School, which is where our Joburg homeboy Elon Musk studied, and also before that, before I arrived, a man called Donald J. Trump. So they really do create monsters, and I consider myself a refugee from that that tradition.
I'm glad. I don't think I'd put you in the same box as the two of them.
Yeah, but I think economists do. But the most important thing that does, influence not just Park Stau, but even his apparently left-wing predecessors, who included, Ibram Patel, who'd come out of a left-wing tradition called workerism in the clothing and textile union and changed 180 degrees, and before him, another Communist Party leader, Rob Davies, before him, Alec Irwin, formerly another workerist. Mm-hmm. So these guys go into power, into DTI, and they realize, in fact, that they have to work with the existing forces of production, that is the big companies. And many of them really do yank the ANC's chain. It's not just Hitachi openly bribing the Chancellor House, right? The ANC fundraising wing, to get the kind of contracts that gave us these Skorokoro power plants, Medupi and Kusile, and were then Hitachi accused and basically pled guilty, prosecuted by the U.S. under Foreign Corrupt Practices Act in 2015, and we didn't do anything on this side. So we've got a political economy here, where, as I say, it's a fantasy. Park Stau, as a Joburg mayor, was well-known, well-regarded internationally, but never did anything to change what this city really has become twofold. First, the most unequal city in the world, if you look at the Gini coefficient, and secondly, the most corrupt city for business, if you look at the PwC economic crime and fraud reports during his time here. So I don't think we'd, entertain a fantasy where I could advise them to go back to 1930s economic policies, which were to take advantage of world financial chaos by delinking and by producing more things locally. And that was amplified in the 40s by the Germans shooting down with their U-boats any ship coming through. So trade ground to a halt. Finance had crashed. And in that period, South Africa grew its fastest ever, 8% per year. And the ratio of black wages to white wages rose its fastest ever because of the labor shortages in white economics, but also that the economy had balanced out. We had manufacturing for the first time in a serious way in the 30s and early 40s. Now, those are the sorts of conditions that exist to some extent. And it would take, instead of an ANC-DA government of neoliberal unity, instead something that would be more progressive. And given the VBS revelations and all of the, I'm not saying that you'd see anything in the EFF and MK party that would reflect any confidence in working for the people's interests. But at least, you know, I think there is a sort of sense that in trade unions and civil society and environmental groups, a very different kind of politics, one that doesn't also rely upon a mythical BRICS challenge. I would just say as a final point on BRICS, sure, what you often hear as a BRICS anti-imperial is in fact sub-imperial. For example, do you remember de-dollarization was all the rage a year ago? Crazy. Just when we talked about it a little, and it was in that Joburg conference that Sim Chabalala, head of Standard Bank, was given the job to speak to the BRICS and say, actually throw cold water on that. Mm-hmm. And those are the sorts of myth-making that the BRICS want to challenge the IMF, World Bank, WTO, and they don't. They're actually perfectly comfortable within it because of the corporate profits that come from squeezing the poorest countries and within South Africa, the poorest people.
Sure. Prof, there's a lot more we could talk about. And of course, lots of debates, and I appreciate your varying views. But to close off with, I guess one key question many South Africans will continue to have is, okay, we headed to the 5th of November, still uncertain as to which way the elections will go. But what impact will it have on an economy like South Africa? And does it matter if the Republicans head to office versus the Democrats?
Yes, and of course, you'd have to worry that the new vice presidential nominee for the candidate under Trump, J.D. Vance, is even more extreme. And the xenophobia, the racism, the America First ideology, let me call this, which they do in the United States, paleo-conservative. You've heard of conservative and neo-conservative, new versions, but paleo is the dinosaur version, right? The Paleolithic. Yeah. And in that sense, to have a Kamala Harris, who comes from some left traditions, I knew her father, actually, who was a Marxist economist at Stanford University, very fine bourgeois university, and he was a Jamaican, a real mensch, but they fell out and he doesn't really talk to her. He didn't like her joking about, you know, her Jamaican origins involving ganja. But I think if she wins, and depending on who the potential running mate is, it would give a little bit more relief the way Obama did. And yet, the big structures of power in the U.S., that is, multinational corporates, and let's say that sort of the base of a class, a middle class and an upper middle class that influences these elections, and they've grown so fat and comfortable from the exploitation of the global South, including getting super cheap minerals out of South African soil through super cheap labor, through women who are producing that labor and social reproduction, getting the workers to the job really cheap. And I don't think they want to end that, to be frank. And I never saw Barack Obama really trying to change those power relations. I don't think Kamala Harris would if she, by some miracle, because she's behind in the key swing states. But if she does fight back and win, we hope she does, of course, don't expect too much change. And if the Trump-Vance combo win, expect lots of racism and anti-African, you know, as they call it, S-hole countries. Expect the AGOA to be chopped, expect aid to be stopped, AIDS medicines to be cut, and climate catastrophe to get worse because, of course, the U.S. will also drop out of the U.N. climate regulatory system, as weak as that is. So it's a bad time ahead, either way.
Prof, there's a lot that we're going to consider. I can't wait to touch base with you before the US elections and after, especially on the back of the intriguing dynamics. And as you say, there's a lot to consider, but we really do need to focus on the fundamentals in South Africa, just getting back to basics and reindustrializing our economy. And then from there, reflecting perhaps on the global partnerships we have. Such a pleasure speaking to you, Prof Bond.
Oh, likewise. Great to be with you. We'll talk again.
Thank you. That's Professor Patrick Bond, political economist, joining us here this evening, giving us a very refreshing perspective and much thought to consider regarding South Africa's participation in the AGOA trade benefits. Of course, even reflections on our global trade partners. But most importantly, how best it is we reindustrialize South Africa's economy.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.